This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We're slated to hear from Kyle Ardoin, the interim Secretary of State. He's running for election in a crowded field to succeed Tom Shedler, who resigned earlier this year. We'll talk with Kyle Ardoin about his surprise to enter the race after initially saying he would not. Also, James Lowen. His book is Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. The Washington Post calls it powerful and important and an instant classic. James Lowen's previously the author of the best-selling book Lies My Teacher Told Me. And we'll have more as we move along today as we enjoy your company on Talk Louisiana. We're sorry about the power shortage, but we're working on it, and hopefully you'll be able to hear us, and certainly online, everything is fine. This is Talk Louisiana. I'm Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us today on WRKF. 877-217-5757 is your number. Our email's talk@talklouisiana.org. Ali Baltazar is producing, and we lead off with Robert Kyle Ardoin, the acting Secretary of State for Louisiana. And he will be on the ballot this November to succeed his former boss, Tom Shedler, who resigned. Kyle took the post on May the 9th, exactly 3 months ago today. And at first, it was thought, and Kyle even said, that he was not inclined to run for the office. But that changed. And let's start there, Kyle Ardoin. What prompted the change of heart?
Well, Jim, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And good morning to everyone. Jim, I really was taking my words seriously, and I had not planned on running. I got a lot of calls the week of qualifying from elected officials, appointed officials, friends, and family. And even the morning of the final day of qualifying, I felt comfortable with the previous decision because, you know, I really felt like I had done the right thing in terms of putting the office back on track and focusing the employees on serving the people of Louisiana. And my phone just kept blowing up. So I visited with my wife about it. And then we visited with our daughter. We Skyped our daughter about it. And she put it very plainly. She said, "Dad, you've been doing the job. And if people really want you to continue in that job, you ought to consider that." So I did. And because of my previous comments, I visited with my parish priest, Father Randy. And we had a good talk about it and prayed about it. And I prayed some more about it and got back on the phone with my wife about it, and then got quiet and felt like that was the right thing to do. I feel like my experience is important to continue the efforts of the office and moving forward, especially in these times of uncertainty in terms of the cybersecurity issues. And whoever takes over is taking over very quickly in December, and then they go right into qualifying for the spring elections, and then, of course, they have to run for re-election in the fall. So I really felt like it was important to have some stability. So I'm putting myself out there. I'm going to let the voters make the decision, and I certainly appreciate their consideration.
Mark Ballard, our friend from The Advocate, who's with us most weeks, says the book on your nightstand is The Plot to Hack America.
It is. I really worry about that. That's something that concerns me on a regular basis. We are diligent in our efforts to make certain that our registration system is protected. I can tell the voters of Louisiana that their votes on the machines are protected. We do not have any machines that are connected to the internet, and there's no computer that programs the machines by our own employees or ever connected to the internet. So we feel very strong in our procedures. We've been lifted up across the nation to the policies and procedures that we have, and as an example for others. And we have a very public process in which we test our machines, because every parish has a board of election supervisors that publicly sees the machines, every machine, and it's tested in their presence, and it's a public meeting, so any citizen can go. A lot of candidates go to make sure that they see that the machines are working accurately. And so we're very proud of the process, but we remain ever vigilant. And I guess I can say I'm an election geek because I think it's one of the most, it's the most important job that I have to do. And our midterm elections are important. Our leadership for our nation is important, and we've got to make sure that our elections are accurate.
How serious is the threat from Russia? There is now substantial evidence that the Russians tinkered with the 2016 election and having a desire to do so again. What do you think?
Well, I think that they certainly want to disrupt our election processes. They want to disrupt the politics through social media, and they want to invoke doubt in the public's mind as to whether or not their votes are going to be accurately counted. And my message to the people of Louisiana is don't let them get inside our heads. Our election processes are good. They're public. They're transparent. And our machines are very accurate. And I would say this, after the presidential election, we had several elections before now, and there was never any talk about, you know, hacking. There was no talk about interruptions or disruptions. But yet here we are again at midterm elections. I think that says a lot about their intent in trying to disrupt the confidence that Americans have in our processes.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to join the interim Secretary of State, Kyle Ardoin, who's running for election. He succeeded Tom Shedler, for whom he worked for more than a few years. And Tom Shedler, as we know many times on this show, was an excellent guest and certainly knew the intricacies of the office. And most thought he was a good public servant, but he certainly had his controversies at the end. How difficult was that process for you, Kyle?
Jim, that was very difficult. To find out that was going on, that those issues existed, cold turkey, if you will, you know, when the lawsuit was filed, was very upsetting and disrupting to our team. But we had a job to do, and I knew that I had to represent the best interests of the agency and for the people of Louisiana. So I stepped up to the plate, but emotionally it was a difficult time for all of us. It's a sad thing that occurred, but the important thing is that, you know, I stepped forward. We initiated a new sexual harassment policy in the office without input from the secretary. I signed off on it, initiated it, and got it done. And the whole point of that is we've got to make sure people have a safe work environment. And, you know, had I known anything was going on, I would have, all the actions would have been different. But I just had no idea. None of us in the executive suite really had any idea. And it was really distressing. But we've recovered. We're moving on. We're doing well. And I think all the employees know I'm very serious about a safe work environment for everyone.
Josh in New Orleans asked a question about voting machines in Louisiana. I think we rely exclusively on voting machines now. Are they safer as far as voter security than paper ballots, or is there a potential problem with the hackers and voting machines?
We don't see any problems with hacking the voting machines. All of our machines are held securely. You would have to be able to reach all 10,000 voting machines undetected. You'd have to be able to unscrew the back panels of the machines, tinker with it, and somehow not be discovered. Again, our processes are very public in testing of our machines before the election and then after the election. So we feel very confident about the security of the machines. Again, there's no evidence in Louisiana about any hacking of machines. It was the political process. And, you know, we work very hard to stay diligent on our security efforts with regards to our voter registration system. So my message to everyone is, The machines are accurate. We test them all the time. We program them ourselves. No outside people touch the machines except for when they're delivered to the polls, but they can't get in the machines because we put tamper-proof seals on them. And those seals are checked in a public meeting with each parish board of election supervisors. So everyone should feel very comfortable with the processes that we have in place. And I feel confident And I think my message is to Louisiana, you should feel comfortable and confident too.
Now, you are not a newcomer to elections. I've noted a few times when Steve Carter's been a guest that he barely won his seat in 2007, representing the citizens of Baton Rouge in the Louisiana House. The final tally was 4,967 votes for Steve Carter and 4,880 votes for Kyle Ardoin. You lost by 87 votes. And from those who have been in the process, most people say it's tougher to lose one like that than to lose by a mile.
Well, I accepted that loss graciously. I could have certainly lamented and gone and found probably 87 plus people who didn't get out to vote, but I really didn't worry about that. I felt very comfortable that God had a plan for me, and I was going to focus on that plan, whatever it might be. And now I feel like I know what that plan was, to have me in the Secretary of State's office some years later, and doing the job that I'm doing now. And I feel very good about it. I'm pleased to be serving the people of Louisiana. And if they choose to keep me, I'll humbly serve. And if not, he'll have another plan for me. You know, people of faith have hope. And when you have hope, you know there's a good future ahead of you. And that's what I'm looking towards.
You're native of Ville Platte.
I am. My family is from Ville Platte. I would have been born there, but my father was stationed in El Paso prior to being shipped off to Vietnam. But I lived the first 2 years of my life there. And while he was away with my grandparents, I lived with him, my mother and I. And it's a great place.
All right, hold tight. We're going to spend some more time with Kyle Ardoin after this brief pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and our guest for another segment is Kyle Ardoin, who took the job as Secretary of State on an interim basis on May the 9th, so that was 3 months ago today, and Kyle Ardoin is seeking election to the post this fall. He noted there will be another election next year because this is part of course, the statewide four-year process, and this is a special election to fill the seat vacated by Tom Shedler. Coming next is Michael Roizen after Kyle. Dr. Roizen is head of the wellness clinic at the Cleveland Clinic and has some fascinating insights on the use of supplements. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Nicholas on Nicholson, Kyle says, our voting machines are safe until we discover they're not. Some of our major companies have discovered they were hacked. So if that happens, what's the difference between them and the safeguards they have and what we're dealing with the state of Louisiana and other states? What do you think?
Well, what we've done is from the beginning is we made sure that none of our machines had any options to be connected to the Internet. We're currently in an RFP process for new voting machines, and we're taking all the necessary precautions with regards to that for the new RFP. In fact, I'm about to have to step into a meeting with regards to that. So I feel like we've taken all the necessary precautions, and we constantly remain vigilant. But again, you know, people would have to have direct access to the machines in order to tinker with them since there's no ability to connect them to the Internet. So I'd say that we are well protected.
Now, the President of the United States last year, after he took office, said that there were 3 to 5 million illegal votes in America and that they all went for his opponent and that he really would have won the popular vote had it not been for these illegal votes. Has there been any evidence of that?
We have not seen any evidence of that. We remain vigilant in working with our federal and state court systems on jury selection. When someone states that they're not a citizen and ineligible for jury pools, then we receive that information and we check to make sure that they are not illegally registered to vote. And so we also get reports from our federal partners, and we are part of the Elections Registration Information Center, which does cross checks across the country with member states. So we're working diligently each day to make sure that we are not registering illegal aliens.
Kyle, one of your opponents, Rick Edmonds, released a press release today saying that he leads the pack in fundraising. He's reporting over $102,000 in contributions. That's not a lot of money as these kinds of offices go, but this is an office that generally does not involve as much fundraising as others. What kind of a war chest do you think you'll have to mount a serious campaign?
Well, my goal is to raise between $400,000 and $500,000. I would say that we've done excellent to this point, having only had 10 days to raise money before the reporting period. We raised $87,400. I'd say we were actually leading the pack in terms of the amount of time that we had and the reporting period and the amount we raised. We certainly didn't spend anything during that period of time. I mean, my understanding is less than around $65,000 in the bank. And so we're definitely ahead on that game.
You got, I think, 9 candidates in the race. So it almost certainly will mean a runoff for the office. So that would mean the next several months will be quite busy for you or any of the other candidates if you have 2 elections in the offing.
That is true. I am working hard balancing the needs of the office with the needs of the campaign, putting the office first. So I'm not as able to get around the state as some of my opponents have been, but we're focusing on doing the job first and running for it second.
Holly in the Garden District asks if we have too many elections in Louisiana. What can we do about the plethora of election dates that we have?
Well, we continue to work to whittle down those special elections. I think that's the issue that we have, especially tax elections. Those tend to be continuous on folks and creates what we refer to as voter fatigue. So my goal is to continue to whittle down those special elections and make sure that they're only on those 4 dates that we have per year. You know, last year would have been an off year. But instead, we had to have a special election for our statewide treasurer, just as we're having a special election for, obviously, Secretary of State. So I think we need to look for ways that we can prevent those from having to occur, perhaps, you know, having a longer period for the appointee to serve. But we'll see. We're working with the legislature, have been for years on those issues, and we are definitely making headway. So tell her, Holly, I'm still working on it, and we'll continue.
There you go. Secretary Shedler last year correctly called the treasurer's race, as far as the paucity of voters, fewer than 20% of us got out and voted. That's a problem, isn't it?
It is, and I think that's the result of the political environment that we are in right now. People are frustrated about that, and I think the neat thing about this office is that we work hard not to run it as a partisan office. We're able to work with all people around the state to register to vote and educate them to get out and exercise their right to vote. So I look forward to continuing to lead that effort and really talking to people. You know, we can't complain if we don't exercise our right to vote. And so I hope more and more people will vote. I think we're looking at probably around a 28% turnout this round because of the congressional elections. But we shall see. Hopefully people will get out and vote.
And Tracy at the Capitol asks about the stipulations in state law regarding political activities by you and your office. There are some restrictions, aren't there?
There are. By law, I'm allowed only to participate in my own political activity and no one else's. So I think that's a good thing, because I think that keeps the office on the straight and narrow in terms of political involvement and make sure that the voters have confidence that we're doing the right thing for the right reason.
All right. And Silas Bogue says, Oregon's system of voting by mail seems fairly straightforward and tamper-proof. Your thoughts?
The easiest way to void a paper ballot is with a pen. And anybody can get a hold of a paper ballot and disenfranchise a person in a second. I'm not for that.
And as far as voter registration, Louisiana ranks very high.
We do. We're We're about third in the nation with about 86% of all eligibles registered to vote. I'm really proud of that record. We've worked really hard, and we continue to work to increase those numbers. We hit over a million, I think it was a year ago, over 3 million, excuse me. And that was a really great statistic. Now we just got to keep it up. And I was at LMA a week ago encouraging mayors and council members to spread the word about being active and participating and working with our office to register more people to vote.
Well, Kyle Ardwin, we wish you well. It's a crowded field. You know many of the other opponents quite well, don't you?
I do. All good people. You know, I'm not running against them. I'm just running on my experience and what I feel like I can do for the people of Louisiana, and that's how I'm going to run my campaign.
The November 6th primary will be followed almost certainly by a December 8th runoff, so we're talking 4 months from right now. We'll be talking about the winner of the Secretary of State's office, the election, the special election, and then it's on to next year. In the event that you do not win, are you through, or do you come back a year from now and say, I'd like another crack at it?
Never say never, but at this point in time, I'm aiming to win this race, and if the good Lord has other plans for me, then I'll follow those plans.
Thank you, Kyle Ardwin. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you. Have a great day.
See you soon. And a reminder that coming next is Dr. Michael Roizen, the head of the Wellness Clinic at the Cleveland Clinic, recognized internationally for its work in health matters of all kinds, but particularly the heart. And Dr. Roizen has some ideas that he wanted to share about supplements and whether they're good or bad. So we'll talk with him. Right now, we part briefly for the news on WRKF with the impeccable Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest is Dr. Michael Roizen. He has more than 40 years of experience as a medical doctor and has been the doctor to 8 Nobel Prize winners and more than 100 Fortune 500 CEOs. He currently serves as the Chief Wellness Officer of the Wellness Institute at the Cleveland Clinic, considered as one of the top 10 hospitals in the United States. He's also the Chief Medical Consultant to the Dr. Oz Show and a best-selling author of 14 books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers. And he's here today to talk about some contemporary issues that we have, particularly with supplements. A lot of us take supplements and the latest trend in the wellness industry. But, Dr. Roizen, you say there's some concerns you have that we should be aware of. What are your major concerns?
Right. Well, the majority of patients who are people who take supplements don't tell their physicians about it. And there are often interactions between the supplements and the medications they're prescribed. So process is that when you take a supplement, it has some interactions and risks often with a medication. So, for example, if you're taking a blood pressure pill and vitamin that has iron in it or calcium in it, there can be a binding and a decreased effect of the blood pressure medicine. Also, if you, for example, take St. John's wort and are on birth control pills, they eradicate the effectiveness of the birth control pills because they metabolize the active ingredient in them much faster. And, for example, if you take vitamin B7 biotin, which is often used for healthy nails or skin, that can throw off a bunch of lab tests your physician sees. So you should either check with your pharmacist or with your physician, or there's a website that I've worked with called Persona Nutrition, which goes over those interactions, has all of the interactions listed on it. So I think you should talk to your physician or pharmacist. But even if you do, the Persona Nutrition is a way of making sure that all of these are okay with your current medications.
Now, many of us take a statin for high cholesterol, and those are powerful drugs. They generally do the job as far as lowering the bad cholesterol, but you say that too is affected by other medications we may be taking alongside it, particularly supplements.
A statin has several interactions. One is if you have grapefruit before, within 2 hours of it, often you will have an increased effect. Now, the increased effect isn't bad usually, except that it can cause muscle pain and other things. And that's because the grapefruit inhibits the metabolism of the statin drug so that you get more effect from it. One of the other effects of a statin is that it inhibits the production of coenzyme Q10, which is important for your muscle function. It's important for all of your energy functions. And so you can feel decreased energy if you don't have enough coenzyme Q10. And it's decreased by about 50% within 30 days of taking a statin. So you want to ask, you want to add that supplement, and so that's one of the things that you could talk to your physician about. Should I be taking coenzyme Q10 when you're prescribed a statin drug?
What about the various medications for inflammation, particularly with people with arthritis? Those, too, have some interaction with supplements that may or may not work. Why?
Yeah, so you're bringing up a whole bunch of common things that have interactions with medicine, which, again, is the reason for talking to your pharmacist or your physician or the Persona Nutrition website, if you will, to look at this. And that is that the, if you will, the anti-inflammatory drugs will have effects with each other and with many of the lab test results that you get, and with other anti-inflammatory effects in negating other, that is, two anti-inflammatories together are not two times as good. They often negate each other's effect in helping relieve pain.
Do you like multivitamins?
You know, I actually do. The data on multivitamins, Jim, is that if you take them for 20 years, that is after age 50, they decrease cancer risk by about 18% in the large men's health study. So that's a huge benefit for non-prostate cancers. And they decrease the need for cardiovascular revascularization by about 25%. Now, that's taking it for 20 years. If you take it for 10 years, they didn't find an effect in the 10-year data or the shorter data. So you've got to commit to it for a long time. Also, for young people, young women especially, taking a prenatal vitamin even before you get pregnant, for 3 months before pregnancy, decreases autism and autism spectrum disorder risk by about 40%. Decreases the chance you'll have any congenital defect by about 85%, and decreases childhood cancers to age 6. That is, the mother's taking the prenatal vitamin plus the father's taking it, seem to decrease the risk of the child getting cancer by about 60%. So these are important things that are doable. So I actually strongly believe that every woman in the who's having sexual relations in the and is in the potentially pregnant era, since 50% of pregnancies are unplanned, probably should be taking a prenatal multivitamin. So yes, I do believe in it, and that is one of the things that is pointed out on the Persona Nutrition website, as well as most physicians will tell you that.
Now, many Americans now are taking soy and iron and calcium as supplements. You say it's a good thing, bad thing kind of situation. Why would it be bad to do those particular things?
Well, we know that calcium, a lot of us are short of calcium. That is, if you look at the daily requirement of calcium, we're getting about half as much as we need for bone strength and for nervous system function and for a bunch of other functions, metabolic functions in the body. That is, calcium is something that's good. But when you take it at the same time you're taking some other things, it will impede the absorption of some of the other things. So that's one of the risks of taking it, and one of the things that we look at. So you want to make sure that if you're taking a calcium or iron or soy, that you don't take it at the same time you're taking many other medications, because it will bind them or decrease the absorption. That's especially true with some of the blood pressure medications. So you may not get the result of blood pressure medication, or you may get a varying effect.
What do you think of glucosamine chondroitin? That's one of those supplements that was not around not so long ago, but now many people take it. The jury's out. It's an expensive supplement, but does it work?
Everyone can find out for themselves where it works. That is doing an experiment on yourself. So it is fairly effective at pain relief. It is not effective as a disease modifier. What do we mean by that? So if you look at the joints of people who take it, they still have the same wear and tear as if they weren't taking it. But it is very effective at pain relief, so it's another alternative to pain relief to Advil or ibuprofen or aspirin if you have intolerance to those. Now, there is one supplement that is very good at modifying disease, which has been studied in France for over 15 years, and now we have it in America, called ASU, or avocado, soy, unsaponifiables. And what that is a very specific and small part of the avocado and soybean that it's less than 1% of them. But the combination of that is together, the ASU, is not as expensive and does in large French studies, modify disease, meaning stops the progression of osteoarthritis. It's the only thing we have. And if you will, the Dr. T, whose name is a long name, who started the glucosamine chondroitin sulfate with the arthritis cure, now strongly recommends ASU based on the data, because it is much better. But glucosamine chondroitin sulfate, if they relieve the pain, very effective. By the way, one of the weird things is if you use glucosamine chondroitin sulfate and you have gout, it's almost pathognomonic. First dose, you get immediate pain relief. We don't know why that is, but you can almost tell if your big toe is hurting and you take glucosamine chondroitin sulfate and get immediate relief, you almost have gout and have to change your uric acid, amount of uric acid or purines that you have in your diet.
Well, is ASU as available as glucosamine chondroitin sulfate?
No, ASU, well, it's almost every store carries all of them, but the glucosamine chondroitin sulfate are very available because they're made by a number of different companies. They didn't used to be that available when it first got popular, but now companies have geared up, so it's pretty darn popular and fairly inexpensive. So it used to be there were only three brands of it, Cosamine DS, et cetera, that were verified as very good preparations. It's now the company's geared up and there's better quality almost across the board with glucosamine chondroitin sulfate.
Well, we've enjoyed the conversation, and it is always a pleasure to talk with Dr. Michael Royzen, the Chief Wellness Officer of the Wellness Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Thank you, Dr. Royzen. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we're joined now by Dr. James William Lowen. He's joining us from Washington, D.C., Ph.D., Harvard University, and his latest work is Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. His book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, was an overwhelming bestseller, and Dr. Lowen, good morning to you.
Hey, I'm glad to be with you in Baton Rouge.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and in your latest work discusses the so-called sundown towns. Can you give us a brief description of what would qualify?
Sure. a sundown town is a town that for decades was, and some of them still are, all white on purpose, okay? And they get their name from the fact that some of them actually posted signs at their city limits saying, for example, and I'm going to have to use the N-word here because they did, and there's no whitewashing this, so to speak, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Manitowoc. Manitowoc is a city of about 30,000. That's about 30 miles north of Milwaukee. And they had a sign saying that into the 1960s. You didn't need a sign. Indeed, I had this conversation with a retired Washington Post reporter, because I live in D.C. now, and I knew he was from Johnston City, Illinois, which is in southern Illinois, and I asked him, did Johnston City have a sign? Did Johnston City have an ordinance? And he said, are you kidding? We never needed a sign. We never needed an ordinance. If a black family so much as tarried in Johnston City, the chief of police asked them their business. So that's how it was enforced, and that's how it's sometimes still enforced.
That is amazing, but there are towns like this in the country, and it's not just a southern phenomenon.
It's not at all a southern phenomenon. Indeed, Louisiana actually stood out because Louisiana had a publication. I'm not sure it still exists because the web may have put it out of business, but it was called the Blue Book of Louisiana, and a lot of states have these blue books. What they were, and maybe they still are, is they were kind of compendiums of government offices and stuff, so that like it had the name and the address and the phone number and so on, and now of course it would have the email address of all of your state senators and representatives and all of the departments and of the government and other stuff too, stuff for every incorporated town just about. Well, in the Louisiana case, this was put out by a private company, and every year they would have a table of all white towns in Louisiana, and it would have about 20 entries in it. And interestingly enough, the entries would change from year to year. That is, you'd think that the table would be just about the same every year, but no, there'd be different towns in a different year. But the thing about it is, all of them were small towns. They were towns of 200 people, 300 people, maybe 900 people, and they were all white, and they may have been all white on purpose. The reason I say it may have been is because I don't typically mess with any town under 2,500. If some come to my attention as a sundown town, well, that's okay. Then I record it and put it on my website and maybe describe it in my book if it's important. But these were all tiny towns. Now, I lived in Mississippi for many years, and so I tried to find every sundown town I could in Mississippi, and I found a total of five, two of which were sundown towns, only very briefly. I also lived in Illinois for many years. I had no idea what I was going to discover in Illinois. I thought I'd discover maybe 10. But I am now at a count of 507 sundown towns in Illinois alone. And that is 70% of all the towns that there are in Illinois. And a similar percentage went on in Oregon, in Indiana, and in various other northern states. So this is mainly a northern phenomenon. And the only place that you find a lot of sundown towns in the south are in non-southern places like the Ozarks, if you consider that the south, or Appalachia coming down even into North Alabama, and also the outside of Florida, and I would argue the outside of Florida is northern, if you think about it, and Texas. But otherwise, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Alabama, except for the northern part there, sundown towns are very rare.
Jim Lowen is with us. His book is Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. And 507 of these towns with more than 2,500 residents, all white in the state of Illinois, the state that propelled Barack Obama to the presidency. How does this happen?
Also, a guy named Abraham Lincoln,
well, yeah,
you know.
If you want to go back away, sure. But
yes. But
this is a state that's regarded by some as being progressive. How is this enforced?
Well, let me say one thing. Not all of the 507 are over 2,500. I got to say that. If towns come to my attention that are smaller and they're confirmed sundown, so some of them are under 2,500. How is it enforced? Well, let me give you an example of an entire sundown county that voted for Barack Obama, whom you mentioned, but was sundown as it voted for him. Okay, and this is Calhoun County. Ironically, it's named for John C. Calhoun, an unfortunate person to name anything for, I believe, because he was a major theorist of slavery and not a very good guy. But anyway, he gets Calhoun County named for him. It's north of St. Louis. It's maybe the most rural county in Illinois in that on one side it's surrounded by the Mississippi River, and on the other side it's surrounded by the Illinois River. So it's a long peninsula, and it only has 5,100 people in it. But they voted for Barack Obama when Obama ran the first time, and they voted for him by 52% to 47%, which is almost exactly what the United States voted him for. But the United States had all these black folks voting, and Latinos, and Chinese Americans, mm-hmm. and so on, and that was not the case in Calhoun County. So actually, the white folks in Calhoun County were more pro-Obama than they were nationally. But at the same time, it was a sundown town, sundown county, indeed, and not one black family lived in the county. There was one family that everybody was very aware of, I would say all too aware of, that was a black father and a white mother, but the white mother was the daughter of a old line white family resident of a, you know, residents of the county, and so that was permitted, and nothing bad happened to them. But that was it. And I asked people in the county, do you think a black family could move in now? That was exactly as Obama took office 9 years ago. And they said, well, no, I don't think so. Maybe if Obama works some miracles, maybe in three or 4 years, but not now.
Well, I'm
not. Well, you asked me how is it maintained. It's maintained this way. If you move in to a place that still wants to be a sundown town, or at least some of its population wants it to be a sundown town, then bad things happen to you. For example, I know in one case a little second-grade kid goes to school on the first day of school, and he never makes it from the school bus to the building. He gets beaten up. Now, if that happens to you, you can't just go home from that racism and kind of nurse your wounds because your house is the civil rights demonstration by accident. So I think you move.
Well, here in Baton Rouge, for example, we have a city that is a blue city as far as how it votes, largely because of the high African American population. But these neighborhoods in the white part of town, in many cases, are totally white, not a black person in sight. And yet, in some of these neighborhoods, actually vote Democratic. It is an interesting concept that we have as far as how we view race in America, isn't it?
We are a fascinating country. Let me go on with one other fact, exactly what you're talking about, with regard to Calhoun County. Calhoun County, having voted for Obama, then last time, that is, a year and a half ago or whatever it is now, voted for Trump by 2-1, by 67% to 33%. So I think there are plenty of white folks who voted for Trump partly because he was expressing white supremacy, and they thought that was the right thing to do. But some of these same folks voted for Barack Obama partly because he was expressing, almost by definition, anti-racism, and they thought that was the right thing to do.
All right. A listener asks, what are your thoughts about the tearing down of monuments in this country?
Isn't that a good question, and good question coming from Louisiana? Well, I do have thoughts about that, and it's going to be a long answer. I'm going to warn you. The first point is we have to ask the question, why did the Confederacy confederate? Or to put it another way, why did the Southern states secede? And that question is typically lied about. And I know because I read American history high school textbooks. I'm the only person, I think, who's read as many. You know, I've read 18 of them thoroughly, cover to cover. And they make it murky. They mystify it. But if you just read what the Southern states said as they left the Union, and I know because I put it together in a reader called The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader with a co-editor, and I wrote all the introductions in that book. And so, first of all, South Carolina secedes, and as they secede, they say openly, we are seceding for slavery, for its extension, for its permanence, and we are seceding against states' rights. And they list the states and they list the rights that really upset them. So you can make no argument that any of the Confederate states seceded for states' rights. They seceded for slavery. So that we have to take that as a given, unless we have some kind of bizarre theory that all of the leaders of all of the southern states lied, and I've never seen anybody put that theory forward. So we have to realize then that the Confederate monuments do celebrate a movement that split the United States into two parts on behalf of slavery. Now, do we really want to celebrate these things? It's not a matter of remembering them. Of course we want to remember the Civil War and why it was fought and what it was about. And by the way, the North did not go to war to end slavery. The North goes to war to hold the country together.
Well, we do have to part, but you're a fascinating gentleman, James Lowen, and we look forward to another visit. The book is Sundown Towns. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.